Good afternoon. You're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, is Arlene Foster building bridges in Killarney this lunchtime? We'll find out what the DUP leader has to say shortly. Is Fine Gael trying to push Fianna Fáil into an extended confidence and supply deal? We'll also have the latest on the Disclosures Tribunal, the trolley crisis and how the Barry McIlduff affair has impacted Sinn Féin. All of that and more to come with our panel, but first it's time for the news now with Susan Jackson. Susan, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You're very welcome to the programme and you're welcome to get in touch over the course of the next hour. You can email us saturday at rte.ie, text us 51551. The Twitter address is at SaturdayRTE. Joining us on the programme today and in the studio, we have James Riley, Fine Gael Senator, Alan Kelly, Labour Party TD, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD, Dan O'Brien, economist and columnist with INM, and Hugh O'Connell, political correspondent with the Sunday Business Post. You're all very welcome. We're going to be hearing from Killarney very shortly because you'll have heard in the news bulletin there that Arlene Foster travelled to Killarney to make a speech at the Killarney Economic Conference. And Micheál Martin certainly says he detects a sense of urgency from the DUP about getting the Northern Executive up and running. We also saw a lot of conciliatory words, Hugh, you might start us off on this, from Arlene Foster on Brexit and about her hopes for both the North of Ireland and the Republic, which she says she wants to see prosper.
Yeah, certainly she's speaking to an audience down in Killarney, I suppose, so she does have to be mindful of that and be conciliatory in that respect. She talks about wanting to retain the common travel area for the border to remain open, recognising the reality that tens of thousands of people cross it every day. And of course, she grew up along the border as well. And at the start of the speech, she talks about how her grandmother used to go across to Clonus to sell lace, many years ago. So she's saying all the right things, but how does that square with the reality that the DUP wants Britain to come out of the single market, to come out of the customs union, and what is the practical impact of that on the border situation?
Okay, well,
so that still hasn't been resolved. And nowhere in the speech, I think, does she actually put forward practical solutions to solve that issue that has remained outstanding for 18 months.
Harry McGee from the Irish Times is joining us now from Killarney. Harry, what we've heard so far is that the language from Arlene Foster was much more conciliatory than it has been, and certainly a very different sort of speech than one we might have heard before Christmas.
Yes, well, there was a lot of strain between the DUP and the Fine Gael-led government in the run-up to Christmas and that December 8th summit where the final conclusions in relation to phase one. And the speech today was being seen as a kind of move, a conciliatory gesture, as it were, to try to make some amends for the fractured relationships that might have occurred. There was lots of criticism from the DUP of what were seen as overconfident comments by the Taoiseach to Simon Coveney and by Leo Varadkar in the run-up to that. So as Hugh was saying there, she talked about the need, she said, the need for an open border, for no regulatory divergence between North and South, and she emphasised the close relationship between both states. She said that it's not in Northern Ireland's interest if the Republic does not prosper. But at the same time, she was very stoutly and very solidly defending Brexit and her party's support for it. And she was essentially trying to cast the new relationship in the context of a post-Brexit scenario. And she didn't get into the detail of all the difficulties that might entail from that, because as other speakers have pointed out at the economic summit this morning, there seems to be a contradiction between alignment north and south, and at the same time alignment east and west, and at the same time Britain being insistent on leaving both the customs union and the free market.
What did she say, Harry, about megaphone diplomacy?
Micheál Martin, she echoed what Micheál Martin said about megaphone diplomacy. He counselled and warned against negotiators rushing to microphones before taking a deep breath and considering the implications of what they were saying. That was taken as a kind of a sideways cut at both Mr. Coveney and Mr. Varadkar. And she more or less said the same thing, talking about the need for people to perhaps cool their heels a little bit before coming out with statements that might have ramifications in relation to a process.
Okay, Harry, thank you very much for joining us from Killarney. That's Harry McGee there from the Irish Times. Dan O'Brien, would you agree with that sentiment from Arlene Foster that really people should step back from the microphone, take a deep breath before they go there?
Yep, I definitely do. There's a very sensitive issue for both communities in the north. The situation there with anyone you speak to on either side has deteriorated both politically and between the communities. And I think it's very incumbent on everyone down here to weigh their words very carefully about what they say. Before the Christmas, the government took a decision to play hardball on this issue. There were good reasons for doing that. The British weren't addressing it. But that did come with a cost. And it came with a cost of alienating not just the DUP. I think it's an important point to make that it was all across the spectrum in the unionist community. There was a feeling that there was an attempt to put a border in the Irish Sea, and that is an extremely sensitive matter for unionism.
Yeah, but what happened today, and as I said earlier, even the very fact that Arlene Foster travelled to Killarney and made that speech means that there is an attempt from the DUP side to build a bridge. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Clearly, if the leader of the DUP was prepared to come down and make that speech in that context, and that's a good thing. And I think everyone needs to try and talk down, because ultimately it's not in the control of the Irish government what happens. It's the British, whatever the British decide to do in the negotiations with the EU. And if the British decide they're going to leave the customs union, there is nothing Ireland can do to stop them.
Oh, Colm Eastwood has just tweeted, I'm told, that this speech was a signal in the right direction, and Arlene Foster is effectively arguing for access to the single market and the customs union. That's a change.
Well, I mean, that could be his interpretation of it, but as I understand it, the position of the DUP hasn't changed. And the position of the Conservative government in the UK is that Britain is coming out of the single market and coming out of the customs union. That's what it wants to achieve out of these negotiations. Now, whether it actually ends up achieving that is another question. But the stated position of the minority government in the UK, supported by the DUP, is that Britain should come out of the single market and come out of the customs union. And there's no doubt about that. Just to pick up on Dan's point, it is important what Arlene Foster has said today, and it is conciliatory. But it's coming at the end of a very difficult week in the north. Sinn Féin MP Barry McIlduff suspended from the party for 3 months. His video where he poses with a batch of Kingsmill bread in his head on the 42nd anniversary of the Kingsmill massacre engendered a lot of bad feeling within unionism towards Sinn Féin. Arlene Foster called it kind of eulogising terrorism. So, you know, at the same time that Arlene Foster was talking about the importance of, you know, devolved government and getting the devolved institutions back up and running, and that's a name shared by both Sinn Féin and the DUP, actually getting there is difficult when you see that relations were frayed further in the last 10 days by the McIlduff controversy.
Dan, you were writing about this in the week, and it was a hard-hitting column. You say Sinn Féin has tried to legitimise the killing of people in Northern Ireland for electoral advancement, and you also say that Sinn Féin has yet to evolve into a fully democratic party.
Yeah, I fully that's strongly my view, and I think we need to go back to where Sinn Féin started from 30 years ago, when its strategy was with the ballot box in one hand and the Armalite assault rifle in the other. Now we worry about the rise of anti-democratic parties in Europe. There is no party in Europe that has that kind of strategy, and no party would be allowed to have it. So Sinn Féin definitely, I don't think anybody could deny, started from a very anti and undemocratic starting point 30 years ago. The hope was that it would evolve into a more normal party, a fully democratic party. At the Sinn Féin Ordesh before Christmas, the huge roar that went up for Martin McGuinness as a proud member of the IRA. So there's no, Sinn Féin hasn't moved away from its support for its campaign of violence and killing in the past. I think that's an important thing. And that was never supported even by the nationalist community in the north. The SDLP always outvoted Sinn Féin when Sinn Féin was involved in supporting a campaign of murder. And I think that's a very important thing to remember, because a lot of young people don't remember that.
So are you saying today, and Louise, you will obviously have your chance to respond to this, that Sinn Féin is still the party of the Armalite and the ballot box?
No, I'm not saying it's still. I'm saying it is part of its process of legitimise that killing campaign. That is still very much part of its strategy now, to say that what it did in the past was legitimate. And I think most people on this island think that the taking of human life at that time was not justified. It was not a justifiable war, as Sinn Féin continues to state that it was. And I think those of us who didn't agree with the use of violence and the taking of life need to stand up and say Sinn Féin will not be allowed to rewrite history and say that it was a legitimate campaign of violence.
Okay, Louise, you haven't evolved as a party.
Yeah, nobody's trying to rewrite any history here at all, actually, in fact. If I could just go back to where we started here with the visit by Arlene Foster to Kerry and the words that she used. And I think there's much to be welcomed in what she's saying. However, the detail on this is missing. So if you go and speak to people who are living along the border, who cross the border on a regular basis and who do business across the border, people involved in organisations like the Border Community, Borders Communities Against Brexit, but also anybody else doing business along the border, they will tell you that they need to see some detail.
And if we had a Northern executive and if both the DUP and Sinn Féin could swallow their pride and get back in there, you'd be able to make that point with a stronger voice.
This is not about swallowing pride. This is about issues of equality, integrity and respect. And we have said, and Michelle O'Neill has said it, Gerry Adams has said it, Mary Lou MacDonald has said it repeatedly, we are up for those negotiations. We are up for those discussions. We want to see the institutions restored. We want to see them restored on a sustainable basis, because that is what people deserve.
They do not. We're 12 months on now.
They do not deserve to have the institutions cobbled together just to satisfy a few column inches in a newspaper. They need to be put together on a sustainable footing,
but
so that they can actually deliver
you would agree
for the people who live
yeah,
in the north.
The people of Northern Ireland at this crucial time deserve political representation.
Absolutely.
In the Northern Executive.
And the people of the North have elected Sinn Féin in large numbers and in ever-increasing numbers. And our people in the North and our people in the South are committed to re-establishing the institutions. But it has to be on the basis of equality and respect.
Okay.
And that is the only basis on which
Kelly,
the institutions would be sustainable.
Louise,
and I will respond to the charge.
Yeah. You've legitimised the killing of people in Northern Ireland for electoral advancement.
We have a party that is, and we have said this on many, many occasions, the party is in transition, the party is evolving, the party is growing at quite a phenomenal rate. And that's not for no reason. That's because of our work on the ground. That's because of our grassroots activity. And that is because of the democratic nature, because people who are members of Sinn Féin have a say in how the party is run. I've just come from a meeting of Dublin Sinn Féin where we heard from Mary Lou MacDonald. We know that she will be seeking nominations to put her name forward to replace Gerry Adams as Uachtaráin Sinn Féin. I was at a very open meeting. It was a fantastic meeting, actually. We
this
had a
morning,
great discussion.
Did this the Barry McAuliffe issue come up?
It didn't, actually, no, but I didn't stay for the whole meeting because I had to leave to come here. And if it did, we will hear Mary Lou echo those words that, and she's been saying this since the beginning anyway, what John O'Dowd said in relation to what Barry McAuliffe did. I'm not going to in any way endorse that or try to defend it. Hurt was caused. It absolutely was. It shouldn't have
been.
But
he didn't mean it, is what Sinn Féin have been saying.
Well, I don't know. I haven't spoken to Barry McAuliffe now. I can tell you that.
Okay,
but
I mean,
I don't stand over
when you
what
think
he
about
did.
It, somebody
it's
who would put a loaf
do.
Of King's Mill bread on his head on the day of the anniversary. I mean, really, can we excuse that away and say, just a bit of a coincidence there. Sorry if it caused offence.
It did cause offence, though. And the important thing is that Barry
has... But Sinn Féin has been saying that he didn't mean it, that he didn't
connect
the two.
The important thing is that Barry has apologised for the offence that is caused, that Declan Kearney has apologised for the offence that was caused, that Michelle O'Neill has apologised. The video was taken down. So I think it's not, you know, we have to acknowledge that there was hurt caused by what happened. I don't stand over it. In absolutely no. And I'm
but
not
what
trying
does
to,
it
I'm not
say about a public representative who
it.
Thinks that's funny, who thinks that's entertaining, who thinks that his social media. But he obviously did when
but
he posted it.
I didn't find it funny. I don't know what was in his head when he posted it, but I didn't find it funny. I didn't come in here to defend it, and I'm not going
okay,
to. But I think the apology that has been issued was entirely appropriate, and the recognition of the hurt that caused, regardless of, I don't know what
so
was intended by it.
But if you recognise all of that, and I take your bona fides on that, should he not have been kicked out of the party? If you feel, as you have expressed just now, that it was wrong, that
no,
it was
I think
offensive,
the sanction. I think the sanction was appropriate.
3 month holiday with pay.
The sanction was swift, and he won't be on holidays. He still has a job to do representing the people in his own constituency, and I'm sure he will be doing that.
So he'll still be doing the same work that he's doing. He'll be paid for it. What's the difference?
I tell you, we have a meeting coming up, a very, very big meeting coming up for our party on the 10th of February, and he won't be participating in that.
So he won't have a vote?
He won't have a vote. He has been suspended from the party, he has been suspended from the Ard Cóirle, and he has been suspended from party activity.
Alan Kelly, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah, I mean, for the last year, I agree with Dan's analysis, but for the last year, we've heard about the institutions can't be in place. Sinn Féin have articulated that the reasoning for that is based around equality and respect. Louise has repeated all that today. And we saw from the actions of Barry McElduff that, you know, it's one-sided because there wasn't much equality or respect in relation to the articulation and actions of Mr. McElduff.
I don't think Louise would disagree with that.
No.
In no way have I sought to defend it. But when I say we want the institutions to be up and running in terms of equality and respect, well, then I'd ask Alan, do you think we should compromise on marriage equality? Is that one that you think we should go back to the lesbian and gay community in the north and say, look at that, we'll let that slide? As the party who ensured it was put to the people,
obviously not.
Well, do you think we should compromise on rights for Irish language speakers? Should we just say no? This is the thing, when you talk about being willing to make a compromise, you have to be able to say what you compromise on.
Alan, go ahead.
Okay, they're very serious issues, particularly the first one is an incredibly serious issue. But having said that, we've had 11 months of this impasse. And here we have a situation where Sinn Féin are speaking out of both sides of their mouths when it comes to equality and respect. That's what people are seeing here. And let me just say this. I actually believe that there's a kind of an ironic paradox potentially going to happen because of the actions of Mr. McElduff. Because this has been deeply, deeply embarrassing for Sinn Féin. It does reflect a light on what they're really like. It does reflect a light on their recent history. It does reflect a light on the way in which they are talking out of both sides of their mouths. And as a result of that, you've seen what John O'Dowd has said in the last couple of days. Now you've seen what Arlene Foster has said today, which obviously is Brexit orientated, but there are certainly undercurrents there in relation to the way in which she's been conciliatory as regards issues. And I agree, by the way, with other speakers in relation to the detail on the border and all of that. Having said that, this is so deep. The actions of Barry McElduff are shine a light so much on the real Sinn Féin, the real party that's out there. Right, and the thinking behind many of their public representatives, that is so deeply embarrassing that hopefully, in an ironic, paradoxical way, this could shove an agenda whereby Sinn Féin are going to have to cut themselves on as part of an equation with the DUP to get the institutions back up and running, because people are seeing through what the real Sinn Féin is.
Louise.
The real Sinn Féin was in the teachers' club this morning, dozens of our activists in a room having discussions, as we do, as I do in my own coming regularly, as we do as a party coming together, having discussions. You know, the real Sinn Féin is at our Ardèche when we formulate policy. The real Sinn Féin is the one that adheres to the wishes of our members. We don't form a policy and then have the audacity to say, well, that's just indicative, you know, we're not going to be bound by that.
Is one
we're
of your bound problems, though, Louise, not that there are two, that there are two Sinn Féins? There's your Sinn Féin, which is the new urban republic, Sinn Féin in the republic, and particularly in Dublin, and there's the old Sinn Féin that we see in Barry McElduff's video.
No, there's not. There's only one Sinn Féin. We have one party. We have one Ard Cóirle. We have one Ardèche. We had one meeting in Dublin this morning. There is only one Sinn Féin. That is a party that 500,000 people across the island voted for. So, you know, people should think on, and speaking in disrespectful tones in generality about the party also reflects on the individual. So I say, I do not recognise I do not recognise my party from some of the stuff I read in the mainstream media. I don't recognise my comrades in the characterisation of some of the people who are members of Sinn Féin. We are a hard working grassroots party.
Being let down by people like Barry McElduff.
Oh, look, you know, I, as I said to you, Claire, and I can't keep saying it, I'm not going to defend what Barry McElduff did. it caused hurt and it was wrong. So,
and embarrassment for you, because you're sitting here and you do in a way have to defend it. You do have to tread that line.
But I'm not going to defend it. I've told you, I'm not going to defend it. I'm not seeking to defend it. I'm saying to you here, and I have said it previously, it was wrong. It caused hurt and it shouldn't have happened. But you know what?
I think that one person is not reflective
Can we just make the point of that the whole party.
That your colleague, Padraig Tobin, was suspended for 6 months because he didn't toe the party line on an issue in the Dáil. Somebody who celebrates or makes a joke of sectarian mass murder gets half that amount of suspension. Why is that?
On the Sean O'Rourke show yesterday, Padraig Tobin was a guest and he spoke about that, and he himself acknowledged that as a person who broke the party whip, which is a very specific thing, and it's the same in every political party where the whip is applied, sanction will be applied to those people who break it. Padraig knew exactly what he was doing. He knew when he voted against the party that there was going to be a sanction, as there would be, by the way, in any party in the
Can
same circumstances.
Can you compare the two, though? Can you compare
the same
two
circumstances in another party for breaking the whip, people were expelled from the party. So, you know, every party has their own internal procedures. Our party is no different.
Last word, James Riley, on this, and then we're going to move on. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that Louise isn't trying to defend what is indefensible, because it just is incredible to think that somebody who is an MP and living in the North and alive to all those sensitivities could do what he did without realising the implications of it. I do want to make a number of points, though. I mean, she mentioned the compromise in relation to the Northern Ireland executive. Certainly you don't compromise on the principle, but you can compromise on the process to achieve the principle. And that's not what's happening at the moment. There's been a standoff between the two parties. That results in no seat at the Brexit negotiations for the people of Northern Ireland at a critical time for them. A province that voted, or an entity that voted, you know, to stay in the EU. And yet they've no representation there. This meeting yesterday, I think, between the new secretary in the North, Ms. Bradley, and Simon Coveney, was very positive. They both shared the one goal. They want to try and get the executive back up and running. That's in everybody's interest. And just in relation to the internal machinations within Sinn Féin and the supposed changes towards the Democratic Party, well, there's been a number of major resignations from Sinn Féin because of bullying. And we only have to look at the manner in which Michelle O'Neill was elected leader in the North to see just how democratic and open their processes are. Can I just say, in finishing, I welcome the fact that Arlene Foster came down, and I welcome the tone of her speech. I know that people will complain about lack of specifics, but I'm also very aware, and I think people will welcome, that the tone is one that seems conciliatory, and that augurs well, notwithstanding events in the last week.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more after this. So, James Riley, the speculation today in the paper that the Taoiseach will attempt to open negotiations for a new confidence and supply arrangement with Fianna Fáil in the summer after we have the repeal referendum. What's your view on that? Will it work? Will it happen?
Which
What's
now?
The strategy?
In relation to
the confidence and supply renegotiation?
Well, look, it's very clear that the government that's in place and the one that preceded it have got the country back on its feet. There's a huge amount of work left to be done. I think we now have an economy that can support the sort of social changes we want.
And I don't want to hear about that. I want to hear about the strategy behind saying in the papers today that we would like to open up discussions. Fianna Gael sources saying we'd like to open up discussions in the summertime.
I think it's sending out a clear message that we think this government's doing a good job and we think it should stay in place. And that we should continue to use the rewards that of people's hard work in terms of getting the economy back on track to support the social problems we have in our housing, in homelessness and in health.
Because the arrangement that currently stands is not up for review until the end of the year.
Why
bring it back? Why bring it back?
Claire, I'm sure you'd be the first person to be down my throat if we said, we're going to wait now till September before we start talking about this. Look, it's obviously common sense and wise to start making the moves now and exploring the possibilities before we reach the deadline of the agreement and its expiration, if you like. So, I mean, to me, I think it's common sense. I know that Fianna Fáil have been out, Micheál Martin's been out, they've had several of their main front bench people out talking about wanting progress on X, Y and Z, and yet they haven't in fact put any policy forward in any of those critical areas of any meaning. So, you know, there's a bit of posturing going on.
But they disagree with that now. They had a policy announced yesterday on housing, for example. Dara O'Brien talking about health being one of the main things.
Yeah, but where's their policy on health? What is their policy on health? And what was their policy on health? And who left the cupboard bare in health so that we had the crisis we had and the financial crisis we had? And I'm not going to go back over that. I think what's important
now... Well, you might
now,
have to now in a minute.
Well, I've no problem going over my own record in health, none whatsoever. But I would say that, you know, they have been very strong on describing what the problems are, but they haven't been very strong on telling us how to fix it or where, you know, in the past the money would have come from to fix it.
That's a bit disingenuous now, James. Come on. Fianna Fáil have put forward plenty of proposals, policy proposals that you guys might
in relation to health,
in relation to housing in particular. I mean, if you see over the summer, they were calling for, late last year, they were calling for the reduction of VAT in the construction sector. So, like, they've put forward a very clear policy proposal there. You probably disagree with it, or
yes, know, I mean, one proposal in relation to
It's not just one proposal though. They've put forward a whole suite of proposals. Barry Cowan has over the last few months in relation to housing, setting out what Fianna Fáil would do if it was in government and if it was in control of the
and there was a suggestion yesterday that we set up a state aid agency to build 90,000 houses.
Well, there you go. So those are the kind of, I mean, you know, we can debate the rights and wrongs of the various policies they're putting forward, but they are putting forward policy alternatives.
Can you tell me, Hugh, what you think the thinking is behind Fine Gael sources saying they'd like to open talks in the summer?
Well, it's nothing necessarily new. I mean, I remember speaking to people in Fine Gael last summer who were kind of saying the same thing, that look, although this is a 3-year agreement, this is something that we'd be open to extending, you know, into the fourth and fifth year, so we get a full term. You see, I don't think Fianna Fáil are necessarily up for that. There's a lot of pressure from within the backbenches of Fianna Fáil, in particular, I think, on the fact that, you know, that they feel as if they've come close to triggering the election quite a bit over the last year or so, and you know, with the various justice crises and Garda crises, and they've kind of marched up to the top of the hill and come back down again. And there's a feeling that they can't really afford to do that again next year, which is why I think that, you know, as much as there's, you know, kind of renewed confidence within the kind of senior levels of both parties that this agreement could go for another year and perhaps beyond that, and certainly in Fine Gael there's confidence about that, I do think the next kind of justice crisis, which might crop up, and Alan might tell us when, in the next 6 months could trigger the next election. You know, so
okay, well, we'll talk about justice and the Disclosures Tribunal in a moment, but I want to come back to health, because I don't know if you read Mairis Houston's article in the last week or so, James Riley. He was hard on you. He said, you presided over a slash and burn of the health service. You almost destroyed Irish general practice with a series of brutal FEMPI cuts. You created a yellow pack pay grade for new hospital consultants, ensuring that many posts attract zero applicants. How do you receive those criticisms?
Well, let's look at the facts of the situation. There was no money in the country. If there hadn't been cuts, and I did introduce cuts in terms of staff pay, in terms of FEMPI to general practitioners, because we had no choice in terms of the money available to us. It was that or cut services in a major way, which would have been hugely detrimental.
Would it not have been better, though, to put in some sort of a clause to unwind those quicker as the economy improved?
Yeah, of course. But, I mean, the whole point around that is that that's a full government decision. I mean, you know, some of the stuff I've read and some of the comments I've read, and I didn't read Mairis's one, but, you know, around the fact that, like, somehow GPs were to be immune from all the cuts that everybody else were suffering just isn't tenable. We had to do what we did, but I utterly agree, and I've said this already publicly on radio, that I want those FEMPI cuts unwound. The financial emergency is over. GPs are now suffering as a consequence a loss of manpower. There's something like 666 GPs over the age of 60 who'll be retiring over the next number of years. That's nearly a quarter of the workforce. So, you know, if we want to retain people and if we want to encourage young doctors into the system, we're going to have to get rid of those FEMPI cuts as quickly as possible.
Is there anything you would have done differently, looking back and looking at where we are now?
Of course there are certain things you would have liked to have done differently. I certainly was very unhappy about the budget of 13-14 and what that resulted in relation to the medical cards. But again, that was a government decision that I was forced to implement. I'm very unhappy about that, was unhappy about that, and had very serious discussions with at the very top level of government in relation to my position in regards to that. But in relation to doing things differently, I would have liked to have seen the money come back in to health, which did come in after I left, to allow us to continue the reforms. And, you know, people have talked about nothing has improved and we made no difference. I can show you on my mobile phone or any, if you want to look up the Department of Health website and look at the trolley count for January 11, then look at the trolley count for January 12, 13 and 14, and you will see a consistent drop. We cut the number of people in trolleys by a third.
Now it's worse than ever.
Yes, but I was gone. The SDU is gone. So, you know, you can laugh all you want.
Ringing endorsement of Simon Harris there, James.
No, I think, no, let me explain what I mean by that. I also brought down the inpatient waiting times to 8 months. Now, they're facts, okay? So why isn't it sustained? Because that was done on with extraordinary effort by frontline staff to put their shoulder to the wheel and sweated as much as they could the system. But you can't do that on an ongoing basis. They did it because the country was in a mess at a time when their wages were being cut, as you've already pointed out. But you can't ask them to sustain that. And because the PMPE hasn't been unwound, general practice now finds itself on the brink. The hospital system has lost a lot of people because it can't continue to survive on the limited resources. Now, we have put in $2 billion more.
The point is that we spend a small fortune on health. So yeah, where is it going?
And this is the point I'm coming to, and it's a critical point. Mm-hmm. I think anybody has to acknowledge that if you've under-resourced something for several years, you can't hope to address that by just giving it the average income for 2 years running, which is what we've been able to do in recent times as the economy improved.
So you can't budget for the medium and long term.
No, we've got to, listen, if we're going to change, and let's everybody admits this now, money alone will not solve this problem, because in the heyday when we had money, it didn't. What we need is the reforms, and the reforms that we were bringing in need to continue. And that takes a huge amount of money, particularly in general practice. If you're going to move from a system where it's episodic illness, looking after people when they're sick, to a system where you keep people well, you've prevention, early intervention. If you want an example of how that works, look at the Midlands initiative around diabetes. They reduced the complication of patients by 80% at a fraction of the cost.
Louise, why have you got your head in your hands there beside James Riley?
Because the very first trolley counted this year showed a number of 677 on it. At 569, when he was Minister for Health, James assured us all that we would never again see 569. And he was right, yeah, because it's gone up to 677. Mary Harney declared a national emergency.
You didn't see it on my watch.
Well, you see, this is not about you as an individual, James. This is about the performance of your party in government for 7 years, and consistently and persistently it's getting worse. Not alone do we have the myriad of crises, the waiting list crisis, the scoliosis crisis, the trolley crisis. We also have a crisis in recruitment and retention. And there's a lot of talk there about the need to incentivise GPs. We have nurses who are graduating. They are among the brightest and the best. We have allied health professionals and healthcare workers in our service, in the health service at the moment, and they cannot wait to leave, or they have left already, or they will be leaving very, very shortly. The reason being, the health service is not an attractive place to work. The solution, put more money into the National Treatment Purchase Fund, siphoning money away from the public sector, putting it into the private sector, will never improve the public sector. It never will.
But it's not. Everything I read tells me it's not a question of money that we are spending. And Dan, maybe you will.
But look at what we're spending the money on, Claire. It's going into the private sector. It's going into purchase short-term solutions like beds in private hospitals. It's going into outside agencies instead of concentrating on delivering a public health service. Okay. We're facing into a crisis.
Claire, the fraction of money going into the private sector.
It's not
is
a fraction
minuscule.
Of the money.
How much is going into the NTPF?
€45 million euros.
Out of how many billion?
20. Plus additional money will go into the private sector this year. Plus people pay from their own pocket. And we will see now, the Section 39 agencies have balloted for industrial action precisely because of the FEMPI cuts imposed on them and the fact that they don't have any pay parity. If and when those agencies go on strike, there will be an unprecedented amount of pressure put on the public health service.
Claire, I mean, obviously this is such a political issue and there's so much commentary about it, but you know, it's obviously a hugely difficult issue to solve. It's been going on for the guts of 30 years now. But when you break it all down and, you know, you get rid of the tit-for-tat politics out of it, ultimately here we have a crisis that needs the following to solve it. It needs greater spend, despite all the commentary about how much we spend, particularly in the capital area. And we have the capital plan that's been going to be announced in the coming weeks, I understand. We're spending 493 this year on capital. It actually needs a huge increase. It needs the type of increase that has happened in housing and more over the next few years to ensure that we have this space and capacity for this bed review, which is coming forward.
But even with that, Alan, is this not a political problem? Because I was reading Susan Mitchell, Hugh, in your own paper, The Sunday Business
Excellent Post, commentary by Susan Mitchell. And by
talking
the way,
about, you know, an overcapacity of acute beds, or we tend to treat everybody in acute beds, which is the most expensive way to do it. Now, you try and close down acute beds in a constituency,
you have
political problems.
We lost a lot of beds in an emergency department in my own town. Right, and we saw what's after happening. Limerick is bursting at the seams because it wasn't the appropriate action to do at the time. So just let me finish. Anthony O'Connor, who's a consultant in Talla, has written very well, very specifically in relation to some of the myths around the crisis. We do need a real push in relation to capital here because we don't have the capacity to deal with this issue. This isn't just an emergency issue. It's actually a hospital issue. We don't actually have this physical space. People are being taken into the emergency departments. They're actually being admitted, but there's nowhere for them to go, right? So the capital review that's coming up, that's going to be announced by Pascal Donoghue, is absolutely endemic to the future of this. We also have Sláinte Care, which is, you know, there's a lot of solutions proposed in that, which is a cross-party. Myself and Louise sat on it. I took 11 months to report. It's taken 7 months to even advertise the key position in relation to it. This is something, if
that
I was Simon Harris,
Friday.
That I would be in the slipstream of, because it does propose many of the solutions. However, and maybe it's a compromise, so it may not be perfect for everyone, of course. However, it's fairly obvious. We have a growing population. The demographics are changing, right? We need more doctors. We need more staff. We need more nurses. We need more consultants. We need to sort out the GP contract. We need greater community care. We need more primary care centres. We need to ensure, and this is a value for money issue, if you provide more home care packages and more home help hours, they're a lot more cost beneficial than people going into nursing homes where it costs $1,000 a week. And obviously, when they go into acute bed, which costs $6,000. This common sense, it's not just about what's right in health, but also financially it makes more sense. And for years and years, we've been dependent on the acute system when really we have to reverse it and ensure people
and
don't end
agree
up in that,
that
system as quickly as they do.
The mistakes made during the recent recession have just led to this being as bad as it is right now. Part of that, you were part of that government, as we know, and there were short-sighted decisions that were taken that have led us to this record numbers of people on trials.
I believe the politics of the last 30 years on health have actually led us to this situation. Lack of intervention in the community care, lack of funding for community care, and a proliferation of basically trying to provide solutions in an acute setting, which is not, and by the way, an underfunding from a capital point of view, lack of investment in people, they are the reasons why we ended up in this scenario.
Okay, well, let's ask The Economist about that. So we have invested, the allocation for 2018 is $493 million capital investment in healthcare. Inadequate or not, in your view?
Can I just say there are tens of thousands of people working in the healthcare system, and it's really demoralising for them to hear nothing but negative stuff about the system. There have been some gains. People work really hard. It's a difficult job. There have been some gains. Over the past 10 years, for example, lifespans in Ireland have increased at one of the bit more than almost any other country in Europe. So there are gains, and let's not all be negative about it. So having said something positive about people who work in the health system, what the negative side is that every time you hear somebody, a healthcare professional, come on the radio or write an article, it's they want more pay for themselves, they want more money going to the system, and they want more colleagues recruited. It's all about money. The fact is that on a per-person basis, we have some of the highest spending on healthcare in the entire world. So there is a problem about how we use the money. And my honest view, we do this almost every year, is that politicians just actually don't want to get in there and make the kind of reforms that would lead to industrial unrest.
Well, that's
and on
what
that
I spent
basis,
my 3 years trying to do.
People
and
pull
that's
back
why you
from
it, James.
And they say, look, let's just try and increase the money, paper over the cracks, rather than actually pick a fight, which would be a major thing.
And who would you need to pick the fight with?
Look, you've issues around that way the hospitals work, around GP, about how the GP system works. There's a lot of fights to be fought there if you wanted to really change things. And I think most political parties just end up saying, look, electorally it is not worth picking this fight, having hospitals closed, having GPs take some sort of action. It's just not worth having the fight.
There's no votes in a 10-year plan for the health service. Yeah. I mean, it's an ambitious plan, and it's a good plan, and I think every politician around the table here has signed up to it. But you know, it's going to take 10 years at a minimum to implement.
Go ahead, James, and we'll move on.
If you go back to capital
if you go back to 2010-11, before we came into government, I made it very clear, and I thought we took a very responsible decision at that point in time as a party to say this cannot be fixed in 5 years. It will take at least two terms of government to do it. Now, we ended up with a financial fiasco in front of us, which did not afford us the resources to do what needs to be done. And I want to make the following point. I did at the outset say the achievements we achieved early on were due to the phenomenal work of the frontline staff. I agree with nearly everything that Alan has said in terms of the resources required. I've made the point already that we need a huge bolus of money to move us from where we are to the new place we need to be. And it can't be with respect to what Dan had to say about closing hospitals. There's no question of that. We know, no, but you were saying that but politicians don't want to take those decisions. When you have no money, those are the sort of things you're faced with. But now that we have money, it should be about maintaining what we have while we build the new facilities we need. About maintaining the one thing that does work very well in the country still just about, which is primary care, but about moving over to the new prevention and early detection model. We need day hospitals.
Many of those primary care centres, lovely as they are, they're not resourced properly.
They are not. And the one in my own constituency in Balbriggan, and Clare, I've asked the HSE numerous times. I get the same response, not just for the one in Balbriggan, by the way, but we have actually asked parliamentary questions in relation to all of the new primary care centres. We ask, will there be additional staff provided? The answer we get is that services will be provided from within existing resources. If this government were serious about resourcing primary care, they would resource
very quickly.
Staff
James,
I want to move
very
necessary.
Just to debunk this thing about the Balbriggan Primary Care Centre, there is now two GP practices in there, one of which has, I think, six doctors in it, which were not there before.
So I'm talking about diagnostic testing, which you could take people out of the hospitals.
I agree 100%.
You're contradicting the HSE. I have asked the HSE on more than one occasion, five occasions.
I want to see a situation where I, as a GP, can look after my patients, have ultrasound, access to ultrasound and X-ray, diagnose and treat myself.
I want to,
I also want to see it in the day hospital where outpatients can be run from.
Leaving that
so
there,
patients can
I want
have their care back in their communities.
I want to take a break because we want to talk about the Disclosures Tribunal after this. Earlier on in the programme, we were talking about crises in the Department of Justice, and Hugh said when the next crisis happens, and then you said Alan Kelly might be able to tell us when that will be. Alan Kelly?
Clare Byrne.
What can you tell us? You've been very involved in this story. We heard more revelations from the Disclosures Tribunal. Noreen O'Sullivan sending suggested statements to Frances Fitzgerald that she might read out in the Dáil, which ultimately she didn't when she was Minister for Justice at the time. You're going to be asking more questions in the Dáil next week, I understand. What will those questions be?
Well, I can break this into two components. Firstly is I do hope the media and everyone looks at what's going on in the Tribunal, because it is absolutely incredible. It's scary. It goes to the very bedrock of our society and justice system. I mean, let's look at this. Last Monday, it was revealed that up to 50 boxes of new documentation, data, correspondence, electronic data arrived at the Tribunal. I want to know, since last February, when Justice Charlton made his very, very open statement about asking people to come forward, why wasn't that information available then or soon after? This needs to be looked into. Obviously, there's a tribunal in operation.
And those boxes came from the Department of Justice and the Gardaí.
The Department of Justice and the Gardaí and the State Solicitor's Office. But in fairness, the latter is probably as a result of the first two. But there has to be a parallel political accountability process here. Because how can the Department of Justice and Garda Síochána be supplying information to the tribunal 11 months after it commenced? There has to be an investigation at a political level, at a government level, at a departmental level. And Charlie Flanagan has to come out and explain this and be held accountable, and his department has to be held accountable as regards what has happened here. It is absolutely scary that the Department of Justice and the Garda Síochána were now able to supply this amount of information, which should have been provided to Tribunal day one. It is, I mean, we need to think about this.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the statement when Peter Charlton made it, calling for people, saying that this is going to cost taxpayers money, that you have an absolute duty to supply information to me.
Claire, supported by the likes of Katie Hannan and John Borkenside and your own organisation and many other journalists across the country, when I put in the questions on the 27th of October and then on November the 8th, I asked the very, very specific questions regarding phone calls from the from Garda Síochána to the Department of Justice. It now turns out they transpired. But my parliamentary questions were fogged off. A whole range of parliamentary questions, probably about 50, were fogged off. Charlie Flanagan needs to come into the Dáil and give the real answers and explain why he didn't give them in the first place.
So what are you asking next week? You're asking about why the boxes took so long to be transferred to the tribunal.
I want to know why all this information has come forward now. I secondly want all my questions to be answered. If I didn't ask those questions and the political crisis hadn't to transpire, we wouldn't have that information at the tribunal, I believe. Secondly, we wouldn't have the new tranche of witnesses, which includes now Noel Waters, Ken O'Leary, Francis Fitzgerald and others, who obviously have a contribution to make. We wouldn't have had them in front of this tribunal if that. So we wouldn't have had the information and we wouldn't have these witnesses, who obviously have a valuable input to give. The second thing, Claire, I want to say is this, and this isn't to do with the tribunal. I mean, I don't believe that the timelines that are in place from this government as regards the Department of Justice and revising the Department of Justice and changing it are in any way tenable or acceptable. I know that there will be other issues and revelations in relation to An Garda Síochána in the very near future. And these issues are very, very serious. And it is not acceptable. And
at the Disclosures Tribunal?
No, this is separate to the Disclosures Tribunal. And it isn't acceptable that we're going to have this drip, drip, drip of very serious issues. And Charlie Flanagan...
Can you tell us what those issues
would
be?
No, I'm not going to get into that here. But Charlie Flanagan can't come out and make the statement like he said during the week that he wants all skeletons out. And you know what? I respect that. I think he's right, in fairness. And I hope he does it. And I'll support him. Genuinely, 100% support him. But we can't have a situation where this is going to be continuous in the way in which now we know the Department of Justice and An Garda Síochána had a hand-in-glove relationship where one began and the other end didn't exist.
We also, Alan, have to respect that we have a tribunal up and running and that tribunal needs to be allowed to do its work.
But Claire, this is where I'm concerned about media reporting. We have to have a reporting, obviously, in relation to the tribunal. But we also have to have critical analysis because these events are quite recent. Mm. They have a political consequence. There has to be a parallel analysis of what is happening because in some cases we cannot allow it to continue.
Okay,
and what I'm saying here is this, is not just will the issues of what's happening in the tribunal need to be dissected and analysed politically on a week-by-week basis, but also the other issues that are going to transpire, and some of them have been partly out in the media and the public domain, some haven't, they will need to be dealt with as well. But the department, we can't wait for this supposedly mirroring breaking up of the Department of Justice, having two Secretary Generals, etc. That is just a joke. That is not acceptable.
Hugh.
Yeah, I mean, like, we should respect the fact and be conscious of the fact that the tribunal is ongoing. We've heard some witnesses. We haven't heard all witnesses. We haven't heard all of the, we don't know what's in these boxes that came in, or we know some of what's in these boxes, but not everything. But there is going to be a political effect from what's coming out of the tribunal. I mean, look, we've been here before with Mann Tribunal and Bertie Ahern in 2007, 2008. The revelations there, you know, shortened his time as Taoiseach, led to his resignation as Taoiseach. So there will be political consequences as the tribunal is ongoing. It's in the public domain, which is the first time we've had, a public inquiry into the various Garda controversies over the last 4 or 5 years. So it will have that political knock-on effect, I think, that is going to make it increasingly difficult. I mean, look, for example, at what's coming out this week about the level of contact between the Department of Justice and An Garda Síochána. And the department at that time headed by Francis Fitzgerald. And yet you have Fine Gael from the Taoiseach down, staunchly defending Francis Fitzgerald, even after she resigned, and giving answers to the Dáil that have now been disproven by what's emerged into the public domain.
Okay, I mentioned earlier on that
and through the tribunal. So
she had a Gmail from Noreen O'Sullivan with a suggested statement which ended, I have complete confidence in Noreen O'Sullivan.
And that wasn't discovered to the tribunal because it went to her Oireachtas email address, which apparently, they might try to argue, was not covered by the scope of the discovery order, which I find astonishing.
But Francis Fitzgerald did not deliver that speech, and she then requested a meeting with Noreen O'Sullivan. Mm. So what do we read into that? That there was tension between them, that maybe it wasn't as hand and glove as some people have said.
Look, like I said from the outset, you know, we haven't heard from Francis, we haven't heard from the commissioner at the tribunal, we haven't heard, or the former commissioner, and we haven't heard from the former minister, but we will. And I think that's going to be illustrated. It's going to be very interesting to see what they have to say. But, I mean, even, you know, if we have to go by the public evidence so far in terms of Noel Waters not remembering a 15-minute conversation with the Garda commissioner at the time, that is, that's hard to believe.
And I asked a question specific to that phone call, and I was absolutely fobbed off. It now transpires it happened. Like, so no, my issue here is, my
but
issue
he,
here
but
is,
Noel Waters didn't remember it, so that's probably why.
Yeah, but the phone records obviously prove that the conversation took place.
Well, he doesn't remember it, and we have to accept that, but it's amazing considering that I asked on November the 8th that somebody didn't just ask, you know, jog memories and stuff like that. Yeah. But
and he had the whole of the Christmas to think about.
Less than a minute left. But for all of you, there's a big week coming up next week, 3-day debate on the referendum to repeal the Eighth Amendment. What do you think the tone of that debate will be?
I hope it's going to be respectful. I'm a member of the Oireachtas Committee on the Eighth Amendment, and we held, despite the best efforts of some members of the committee, we held very respectful discussions. I am hopeful that the debate will be respectful and will be mindful of how important this issue
James,
is.
James, I'm over time, so as quick as you can.
Well, I hope that also people will be afforded the space to make their minds up, to consider all the facts that have been presented by the committee. And I believe when they do, I think we'll have a much more rational outcome than and debate than we've had in the past on this very divisive issue.
I hope, I agree with those previous comments to speakers. I hope every public representative in Dáil Éireann and Shannon Éireann will actually state what their position is. And what really, you know, isn't acceptable is the idea that some people say that they, you know, that they haven't looked into the subject and made a decision as regards
where they're
going.
You're asking them to read the report.
Basically,
okay,
yes.
Fianna Fáil have been on to say that they can provide James Riley with any of their policy documents. So we'll have those for you. We're gone.
The one-liner on health, I look forward to.
Okay, back next week. Enjoy the weekend. Thank you for listening.